Chapter 10 was over between them, and that it mattered not what she did, or he, her husband stood still, regarding her. Their lives were ruined, he thought, ruined by the fundamental error of their matrimonial union. That of having based a permanent contract on a temporary feeling which had no necessary connection with affinities, that alone render a lifelong comradeship tolerable. Going to ill-use me on principle, as your father ill-used your mother, and your father's sister ill-used her husband, she asked. LLU be a queer lot as husbands and wives. Jude fixed an arrested, surprised look on her. But she said no more, and continued her saunter till she was tired. He left the spot, and, after wandering vaguely a little while, walked in the direction of Marygreen. Here he called upon his great-aunt, whose infirmities daily increased. "Aunt, did my father ill-use my mother, and my aunt her husband?" said Jude abruptly, sitting down by the fire. She raised her ancient eyes under the rim of the bygone bonnet that she always wore. "Who's been telling you that?" she said. "I have heard it spoken of, and want to know all. You met so well, I suppose. Though your wife I reckoned was she must have been a fool to open up that. There isn't much to know after all. Your father and mother couldn't get on together, and they parted. It was coming home from Alfredston Market, when you were a baby on the hill by the Brown House barn, that they had their last difference, and took leave of one another for the last time. Your mother soon afterwards died, she drowned herself, in short, and your father went away with you to South Wessex, and never came here anymore." Jude recalled his father's silence about North Wessex and Jude's mother, never speaking of either till his dying day. "It was the same with your father's sister. Her husband offended her, and she so disliked living with him afterwards, that she went away to London with her little maid. The Follies were not made for wedlock. It never seemed to sit well upon us. There's some mad in our blood that won't take kindly to the notion of being bound, to do what we do readily enough if not bound. That's why you ought to have hearkened to me, and not have married. Where did father and mother part by the Brown House, did you say?" "A little further on where the road to Fenworth branches off, and the handpost stands. A gibbet once stood there not unconnected with our history. But let that be." In the dusk of that evening Jude walked away from his old aunt's as if to go home. But as soon as he reached the open down he struck out upon it till he came to a large round pond. The frost continued, though it was not particularly sharp, and the larger stars overhead came out slow and flickering. Jude put one foot on the edge of the ice, and then the other. It cracked under his weight, but this did not deter him. He plowed his way inward to the center, the ice making sharp noises as he went. When just about the middle he looked around him, and gave a jump. The cracking repeated itself, but he did not go down. He jumped again, but the cracking had ceased. Jude went back to the edge, and stepped upon the ground. It was curious, he thought. What was he reserved for? He supposed he was not a sufficiently dignified person for suicide. Peaceful death abhorred him as a subject, and would not take him. What could he do of a lower kind than self-extermination? What was there less noble, more in keeping with his present degraded position? He could get drunk. Of course that was it. He had forgotten. Drinking was the regular, stereotyped resource of the despairing worthless. He began to see now why some men boozed at inns. He struck down the hill northwards, and came to an obscure public house. On entering and sitting down the sight of the picture of Samson and Delilah on the wall, caused him to recognize the place as that he had visited with Arabella on that first Sunday evening of their courtship. He called for liquor, and drank briskly for an hour or more. Staggering homeward late that night, with all his sense of depression gone, and his head fairly clear still, he began to laugh boisterously, and to wonder how Arabella would receive him in his new aspect. The house was in darkness when he entered, and in his stumbling state it was some time before he could get a light. Then he found that, though the marks of pig dressing, of fats and scallops, were visible. The materials themselves had been taken away. A line written by his wife on the inside of an old envelope was pinned to the cotton blower of the fireplace. "Have gone to my friends. Shall not return." All the next day he remained at home and sent off the carcass of the pig to Alfredston. He then cleaned up the premises, locked the door, put the key in a place she would know if she came back, and returned to his masonry at Alfredston. At night when he again plodded home, he found that he had not visited the house. The next day went in the same way, and the next. Then there came a letter from her. That as he had gone tired of him, she frankly admitted. He was such a slow old coach, and she did not care for the sort of life he led. There was no prospect of his ever bettering himself or her. She further went on to say that her parents had, as he knew, for some time considered the question of emigrating to Australia, the pig jobbing business being a poor one nowadays. They had at last decided to go, and she proposed to go with them, if he had no objection. A woman of her sort would have more chance over there than in this stupid country. Jude replied that he had not the least objection to her going. He thought it a wise course, since she wished to go, and one that might be to the advantage of both. He enclosed in the packet containing the letter the money that had been realized by the sale of the pig, with all he had besides, which was not much. From that day he heard no more of her except indirectly, though her father and his household did not immediately leave, but waited till his goods and other effects had been sold off. When Jude learned that there was to be an auction at the house of the Dons, he packed his own household goods into a wagon, and sent them to her at the aforesaid homestead, that she might sell them with the rest, or as many of them as she should choose. He then went into lodgings at Alfredston, and saw in a shop window the little handbill announcing the sale of his father-in-law's furniture. He noted its date, which came and passed without Jude's going near the place, or perceiving that the traffic out of Alfredston by the southern road was materially increased by the auction. A few days later he entered a dingy broker's shop in the main street of the town, and amid a heterogeneous collection of saucepans, a clothes horse, rolling pin, brass candlestick, swing-looking glass, and other things at the back of the shop, evidently just brought in from a sale, he perceived a framed photograph, which turned out to be his own portrait. It was one which he had especially taken and framed by a local man in Birdseye Maple, as a present for Arabella, and had duly given her on their wedding day. On the back was still to be read, "Jude to Arabella," with the date. She must have thrown it in with the rest of her property at the auction. "Oh," said the broker, seeing him look at this and the other articles in the heap, and not perceiving that the portrait was of himself. "He is a small lot of stuff that was knocked down to me at a cottage sale out on the road to Marygreen. The frame is a very useful one, if you take out the likeness. You shall have it for a shilling." The utter death of every tender sentiment in his wife, as brought home to him by this mute and undesigned evidence of her sale of his portrait and gift, was the conclusive little stroke required to demolish all sentiment in him. He paid the shilling, took the photograph away with him, and burned it, frame and all, when he reached his lodging. 2 or 3 days later he heard that Arabella and her parents had departed. He had sent a message offering to see her for a formal leave-taking, but she had said that it would be better otherwise, since she was bent on going, which perhaps was true. On the evening following their emigration, when his day's work was done, he came out of doors after supper, and strolled in the starlight along the too familiar road towards the upland whereon had been experienced the chief emotions of his life. It seemed to be his own again. He could not realize himself. On the old track he seemed to be a boy still, hardly a day older than when he had stood dreaming at the top of that hill, inwardly fired for the first time with ardors for Christminster and scholarship. "And I am a man," he said. "I have a wife. More, I have arrived at the still riper stage of having disagreed with her, disliked her, had a scuffle with her, and parted from her. He remembered then that he was standing not far from the spot at which the parting between his father and his mother was said to have occurred. A little further on was the summit whence Christminster, or what he had taken for that city, had seemed to be visible. A milestone, now as always, stood at the roadside hard by. Jude drew near it, and felt rather than read the mileage to the city. He remembered that once on his way home he had proudly cut with his keen new chisel an inscription on the back of that milestone, embodying his aspirations. It had been done in the first week of his apprenticeship, before he had been diverted from his purposes by an unsuitable woman. He wondered if the inscription were legible still, and going to the back of the milestone brushed away the nettles. By the light of a match he could still discern what he had cut so enthusiastically so long ago. Thither J.F., with a pointing finger, the sight of it, unimpaired, within its screen of grass and nettles, lit in his soul a spark of the old fire. Surely his plan should be to move onward through good and ill to avoid morbid sorrow, even though he did see uglinesses in the world. Being a jeer et litari, to do good cheerfully, which he had heard to be the philosophy of one Spinoza, might be his own even now. He might battle with his evil star, and follow out his original intention. By moving to a spot a little way off, he uncovered the horizon in a northeasterly direction. There actually rose the faint halo, a small dim nebulousness, hardly recognizable save by the eye of faith. It was enough for him. He would go to Christminster as soon as the term of his apprenticeship expired. He returned to his lodgings in a better mood, and said his prayers. Part 2nd, at Christminster, save his own soul he hath no star. Swinburne. Atidium primus gratus vicinia fecit, temper crevit amor. Ovid. The next noteworthy move in Jude's life was that in which he appeared gliding steadily onward through a dusky landscape of some 3 years later leafage than had graced his courtship of Arabella, and the disruption of his coarse conjugal life with her. He was walking towards Christminster City, at a point a mile or two to the southwest of it. He had at last found himself clear of Marygreen and Alfredston. He was out of his apprenticeship, and with his tools at his back seemed to be in the way of making a new start, the start to which, barring the interruption involved in his intimacy and married experience with Arabella, he had been looking forward for about 10 years. Jude would now have been described as a young man with a forcible, meditative, and earnest rather than handsome cast of countenance. He was of dark complexion, with dark harmonizing eyes, and he wore a closely trimmed black beard of more advanced growth than is usual at his age. This, with his great mass of black curly hair, was some trouble to him in combing and washing out the stone dust that settled on it in the pursuit of his trade. His capabilities in the latter, having been acquired in the country, were of an all-round sort, including monumental stone-cutting, Gothic freestone work for the restoration of churches, and carving of a general kind. In London he would probably have become specialized, and have made himself a Olding mason, a oleage sculptor, perhaps a statuary. He had that afternoon driven in a cart from Alfredston to the village nearest the city in this direction, and was now walking the remaining 4 miles rather from choice than from necessity, having always fancied himself arriving thus. The ultimate impulse to come had had a curious origin, one more nearly related to the emotional side of him than to the intellectual, as is often the case with young men. One day while in lodgings at Alfredston he had gone to Marygreen to see his old aunt, and had observed between the brass candlesticks on her mantelpiece the photograph of a pretty girlish face, in a broad hat with radiating folds under the brim like the rays of a halo. He had asked who she was. His grand-aunt had gruffly replied that she was his cousin Sue Brighthead, of the inimical branch of the family, and on further questioning the old woman had replied that the girl lived in Christminster, though she did not know where or what she was doing. His aunt would not give him the photograph, but it haunted him, and ultimately formed a quickening ingredient in his latent intent of following his friend the schoolmaster thither. He now paused at the top of a crooked and gentle declivity, and obtained his first near view of the city. Gray-stoned and unroofed, it stood within hail of the Wessex border, and almost with the tip of one small toe within it, at the northernmost point of the crinkled line along which the leisurely Thames strokes the fields of that ancient kingdom. The buildings now lay quiet in the sunset, a vein here and there on their many spires and domes giving sparkle to a picture of sober secondary and tertiary hues. Reaching the bottom, he moved along the level way between pollard willows growing indistinct in the twilight, and soon confronted the outmost lamps of the town, some of those lamps which had sent into the sky the gleam and glory that caught Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.